From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. We'll get an update on the algal blooms on Lake Erie, the same kind that shut Toledo's water system down 3 years ago.
Anytime there's a bloom, there is a risk of human health impacts, whether it's from drinking water or recreation. There's always a risk.
A new report indicates past Michigan legislatures have committed the state to an ever-shrinking general fund.
We are losing ground rather quickly, and we're not finding a way to make it up.
A battle in rural areas to get decent internet service.
It's disheartening when I see the opportunities that are being missed in our communities that don't have any connectivity.
And Cheers sends me to a brewery for the first time in this series.
So what's the philosophy here? I understand you do Belgians. I'm not a big Belgian fan.
Well, we're here to change that, Lester.
First, the news. Welcome to Stateside on this first Friday of August 2017. I'm Lester Graham. Today, we'll be examining the cause and effect between farmers' use of fertilizer and the giant algal blooms in Lake Erie. And could the state of Michigan's general fund be heading for some shortages in the future? That's coming up later in the hour. First, many rural areas in Michigan don't have access to high-speed internet service. I mean, imagine not being able to get important work mail, work emails, or even worse, not being able to binge watch Netflix. Well, people in Linden Township near Ann Arbor want to change that for their township. They could vote for a fix in Tuesday's election. Michigan Radio's Tyler Scott has more on that.
Bart and Mary Beth Hammer live on a lake in Linden Township north of Chelsea. They've got a beautiful home with a great view, but their internet connection would drive most city folk insane.
You can get a satellite dish, but it's so slow and you only get a small amount of data that you can't stream anything, so if you want to do any streaming, you cannot do it.
In Linden Township, even downloading an email attachment can be a pain. There aren't many companies providing high-speed internet without expensive data caps. People end up paying big bucks for internet that's just so-so.
I'm paying multiple hundreds of dollars a month for the cellular access that I get that does not meet my needs, and my situation is not unique.
Ben Feynman also lives in Linden Township.
It's disheartening when I see the opportunities that are being missed in our communities that don't have any connectivity.
A couple of years ago, Ben and some other people started a group called Michigan Broadband Cooperative to do what the internet companies won't, bring high-speed internet to their neighborhood.
We found a whole lot of pent-up demand and frustration. People's frustration has just been growing with the increasing inability to participate in modern society.
They've been working for about 2 years. They sent out surveys and got the township to pay for a feasibility study and eventually to put the issue on the ballot. Mark Kieser is the Linden Township supervisor. He's sitting in a cafe drinking a latte.
Us as a local township board, we just fostered it along the way. But it is pretty much a grassroots effort.
There's still a lot of details that have to be worked out, but on August 8th, Linden Township voters will have this basic choice.
Yeah, what they're going to decide for is it's a broadband network, and the infrastructure that will be installed is fiber optics. So it'll be fiber optics to each and every home throughout Linden Township. The price of that is 2.9 mils of taxable value per parcel.
And that's for the next 20 years. A home with a taxable value of, say, $100,000 will pay a little less than $300 a year in taxes, plus a monthly fee for internet service. In theory, people will be paying at least a comparable amount for internet that's way better. Kieser says he knows it's a project that will help the community, but
we don't particularly want to build a network in our township. We would rather it be privatized and be like everybody else, but that's not a reality for us here in Linden Township.
Linden Township wouldn't be the first local government in Michigan to take the issue into their own hands. Sebewing, Michigan, built a fiber-to-the-home network through its city utility company a few years ago. But Linden Township would be doing it a little differently, likely building the raw infrastructure, then partnering with a private company to actually come in and provide the service and maintain the network. There seems to be a lot of public support from people like the Hammer family, who are sick of shoddy internet.
Yeah, we'll definitely vote yes, and we'll also, you know, if it comes through, we'll be paying to whatever it costs to make it happen.
If the proposal passes, it'll take about a year and a half to build the network. Then people in Linden Township will finally be able to tell you about it on Facebook. For Stateside, I'm Tyler Scott.
Today, the movie, simply titled Detroit, debuts nationwide. It depicts the most notorious single incident of the 1967 Detroit Rebellion, the brutal police killings of three black teens at the Algiers Motel. One of those young men was 19-year-old Aubrey Pollard. Michigan Radio's Sarah Swick spoke with Carol Hall. She was Pollard's teacher in junior high school. Hall remembers Pollard extremely well. She calls his death one of the most painful times in her life, something that's affected her ever since.
The student's name was Aubrey Pollard, and Aubrey was in a special class. Everyone thought was incapable of learning. And that wasn't unusual in those times because it was just kind of assumed if you were a black student that you had difficulty learning. That was an assumption. Aubrey's class was a class that said, these kids are smart. After a few weeks with them, I decided to assign every student a term paper in black history. We decided to let them do a speech on the person that they had selected. Aubrey came up, maybe the third or fourth student to do his presentation. It was Frederick Douglass. No note cards. He just brrr. It was so brilliantly done. He clearly understood everything that was happening. He clearly felt very deeply about what he had just learned. After that assignment, closer to the ninth grade, Aubrey kind of began to shift away from the class. He was always very mature for his age, but I noted that his, not his demeanor per se changed, but his clothing changed, his hair changed. And I realized that Aubrey loved the girls, and the girls were there. He had that charm. Finally, Aubrey came to me at one point and said he was leaving school. And I knew from the way he talked that there was no talking him out of it. If I had not known what he had already done, I would have said that maybe he was having some difficulty learning. Definitely wasn't it. It's clear that outside of the school environment, something else had recognized that, or he had recognized something else that was out in the environment that he was beginning to lock into. He wanted to be in the world. I thought about him, and I went on with the rest of the members of that class. In 67, of course, you know, the riot occurred. Tanks came up my street, and I looked on my front porch, and I looked up, and I saw smoke and flames. And I thought, oh, my God, what is happening here? And this was critical for me because I had already lived through a riot when I was a little girl in Detroit on the east side off of Hastings Street. It frightened me so I grabbed the children, jumped in a car, and drove to Chicago. Got back, and one of the first things that I read, people had been killed, and one of the first names I saw was Aubrey's, that he had been killed in a hotel. Talking to as many colleagues as I could, the word was that the police had broken in, and that, and some had said that there was an issue of so-called prostitution, possibly. But the word was that he was not killed resisting anything, that he was simply killed because there were black women, there were white women, and other women, and there was a rage, and that it was done by a white police officer. Just things started hitting my mind from everywhere. And add to that, I had three boys. And I'm thinking, what's going to happen to my sons? What is their life going to be like? I knew it as well as I knew my grandfather had to leave, my great-grandfather had to leave Alabama. That Aubrey's death was not going to be resolved, that they were not going to find anybody guilty. Finally, I had time to think about what was I going to do. That it wasn't enough to teach. I needed to act. We decided to take that graduating class, and we were going to make sure every student in that next class had an opportunity to apply for a job, to get into training, to apply to college, all three. We were able to do an 80% placement before the third month after graduation. I think too often of Aubrey and that I have not done enough. I say that with a sense of optimism still. I still have that. And I have it because I don't think Aubrey died in vain. To some extent, I think all of us have at some point a nexus of some type that motivates us to do something. It's not always in our face. It's not always in our ear. And we're not always thinking about it. But it has been the catalyst for something major that has happened in my life and in our lives. And Aubrey has been that for me.
That was Carol Hall remembering her former student, Aubrey Pollard, who was one of three people killed at the Algiers Motel during the 1967 rebellion. Actor Nathan Davis Jr. plays Pollard in the film Detroit, which opens today in theaters nationwide. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Well, there's not much happening with the Michigan legislature this summer, but it did approve a budget on time of more than $56 billion. A lot of that money's tied to particular programs. The legislature really only has discretion with the $10 billion general fund. A report from the nonprofit, nonpartisan Citizens Research Council of Michigan indicates that general fund is going to be hit hard over the next few years, making budget decisions tougher in the future. Here to talk about that are Vicki Barnett, a former mayor of Farmington Hills and a former Democratic legislator, and Ken Sikkema, senior policy fellow with Public Sector Consultants and the former Republican majority leader in the state Senate. He joins us by Skype. Vicki, as much as 20% of the general fund is going to be tied up by obligations, according to the CRC report. What's causing that?
Well, there's a lot of earmarks that are in the general fund. Whenever we give a tax credit to a business that comes out of the general fund, we're not bringing in as much money into the school aid fund as required to fund public education. So some of that money in the general fund is diverted to the school aid fund. There's also other pressures. For example, when we repealed the personal property tax, which is a tax that businesses pay in local communities, we promise to hold those local communities harmless in that deal. So there will start to be diversions from the general fund to repay the shortfall in local governments for the personal property tax repeal. In addition, we also have some other pressures that was part of the road funding package where we promised to pay up to $800 million a year, which is almost 8% of that general fund budget to the transportation fund because there was not enough money in the sales tax revenue that we increased in order to cover that. So that was part of the deal. So more and more money is being siphoned off of the general fund. But I want to point out that the general fund has been relatively flat this entire millennium. For example, in 2001, the general fund budget was $9.902 billion. In real dollars, translated to 2017, that would be over $14 billion now. So we're actually losing ground. And the $10 billion we have as a buying power of $7 billion in the 2000 era. So we are losing ground rather quickly, and we're not finding a way to make it up.
Ken, a good deal of this appears to be instances of kicking the can down the road, and it's now catching up to us. We're in good economic times right now, but it's hard to say where we'll be in 4, 5, 6 years. What do you think the legislature should be considering as it looks ahead?
Well, from my standpoint, you know, the Republican Party has historically championed itself as the party of fiscal integrity. I think they're sort of losing that reputation nationally and even here in Michigan, because one of the big issues here in this Citizens Research Council report is that you really have one legislature, in the case of road funding, one legislature making spending and tax cut commitments for the future that a future legislature has to reconcile and address. And in the case of road funding, that is a departure, you know, using the general fund to fund roads rather than just the gas tax or some kind of user pay tax or fee. That's really, really different than the past. So that really is the sort of where the Republican legislature majority has to take some ownership over this, that they are kicking the can down the road. They're making future commitments that a future legislature is going to reconcile.
Vicki, you did a good job of going through the list, but I want to put some money to that. For example, the tax credits under the Michigan business tax, that's about $600 million each year coming out of the general fund. Then there's the transportation investment package we just talked about. That ramps up to about $600 million out of the general fund eventually. Then there's the homestead property tax credit for low-income households to help offset higher gas taxes and registration fees that go into paying for part of the road plan. And finally, the state agreed it would reimburse local governments and school budgets for the tax money lost due to the exemptions for the industrial and commercial personal property taxes, as you mentioned, Vicki. All told, it's $2 billion out of a $10 billion general fund. So, Vicki, what can be done beyond cutting government services or raising taxes?
Well, that's the choice that you're faced with. The services that we provide are very minimal compared to what they were years ago. And students who go to public universities feel it every day because it's resulted in huge increases in tuition that they have to pay because the state isn't stepping up to help fund the universities the way it used to. I want to go back to two things, though, which I think are causing additional pressure on the budget that we haven't talked about. One is when Governor Snyder came in and repealed the Michigan business tax, there was a change to the corporate income tax, and it revamped everything, including personal income tax structure. And that cut revenues to the state by $2 billion annually. And there was no hue and cry over that, and yet the governor at the same time wanted to raise $1.8 billion a year for road funding, and so did the business leaders for Michigan. So we had a huge cut in what could have been a growing general fund at that point. In addition, term limits, I think, are playing a huge backstory in the general fund revenue problem, because there's no expertise that builds up over time, and new legislators come in, want to make their mark, and don't understand all of the other cuts and pressures that are on the general fund budget as it stands now. So we have an inexperienced legislature coming in every few years without recognizing the toll that all of these changes are taking on our ability to deliver high-quality services to our citizens.
And often they're gone before the ramifications of their votes and are felt. Ken, a lot of voters are absolutely convinced if we could remove the tax, we could just remove this tax burden if we could just get rid of waste, fraud, and abuse. In fact, on August 16th, a legislator is once again going to propose phasing out the personal income tax because he believes the state can cut spending even further. What do you think the reality is?
When you don't really know how to cut spending, or you don't want to cut spending, you always go to the old canard of, well, let's just cut waste, fraud, and abuse without defining what it is, because someone else's waste is someone else's essential program. But that's not that's just not a realistic policy alternative. There's no meaning there. And as both you and Vicki have pointed out, that in the near future, there's going to be some tremendous pressure on the general fund. What's one of the great ironies, I think, is a total of a $56 billion state budget. The legislature really only has discretion over $10 billion.
I would like to talk about the personal income tax. It contributes approximately $7 billion of that $10 billion to the general fund. And every time you chip away at that, you're directly cutting the general fund because it is the largest contributor to general fund general purpose revenue.
That's Vicki Barnett. She's a former mayor of Farmington Hills and a former Democratic legislator. Ken Sikkema is senior policy fellow with Public Sector Consultants and a former Republican legislator. Thanks to both of you. I appreciate the insight.
My pleasure. Thanks.
Thanks, Lester.
For a year and a half now, Tammy Coxon with Tammy's Tastings and I have been bringing you our Cheers segment on Stateside. Every other week, we tell you about a craft cocktail, about Michigan spirits and other products. Sometimes we visit a craft cocktail bar or a distillery. Well, recently we were in Grand Rapids, also known as Beer City. So we decided we really needed to visit our first brewery.
Cheers.
Cheers.
Hi, Tammy.
Hi, Lester.
So we're in Grand Rapids. Where are we right now?
We are at Brewery Vivant, and Kate Avery, their abbess of beer, is going to tell us all about what they do here.
So what's the philosophy here? I understand you do Belgians. I'm not a big Belgian fan.
Well, we're here to change that, Lester. We're here at Brewery Vivant. We brew in the kind of farmhouse tradition, so it's a little bit more yeast-driven than hops-driven, and it allows us to explore some different flavor profiles as far as craft beer goes in the state of Michigan.
Tell us about this facility, because it's really interesting.
Yeah, we're sitting in the chapel here at 925 Cherry Street in East Hills, and it actually, prior to being a brewery, was a funeral home chapel. So there's these big vaulted ceilings and exposed wooden beams. The bar has a nice little stained glass window above it. There's an organ loft.
It's altar to beer.
It really did make me feel a little bit like I was someplace in Belgium, so it really does fit with your style. So we like to have a Michigan focus when we talk about drinks on the show, and obviously you have a great Michigan focus just because you're made here, but I know you also have some Michigan sourcing practices. Can you tell us about that?
At Brewery Vivant, we're really interested in running our business according to the triple bottom line, and that's how our actions influence people, profit, and planet. And to the planet part and to the people part, we want to support our local economies. So sourcing the raw ingredients for our beers and for our food here at the pub is really important to us. So we do have some local sourcing goals every year, one of which is to source 25% of our raw beer inputs from within 250 miles. And luckily, being in the bread basket, the fruit basket of America's High Five, we are able to do a pretty good job on that goal. Our flagship beer, Farmhand, a farmhouse ale, very traditional kind of French-style beer, that actually uses 100% Michigan wheat.
Well, I guess it's time for you to persuade me that Belgian is a good beer.
Well, this is Michigan beer, Lester. What I'd like y'all to try is this flagship Farmhand, a light, refreshing, crisp kind of saison. It's supposed to be our interpretation here. It's supposed to be a beer that you can drink after a long day out on the farm.
I just had a saison a couple of weeks ago, and this is not the same thing. It's a lot more refreshing. It's light, surprising, and I kind of like it.
Yeah, for me, you know, I'm not a Pilsner person. I don't like the typical lawnmower beers. This is what I would want to drink after being out in the yard all day long in this crazy kind of heat.
Farmhand is just one of those go-to beers. It is light and refreshing. It's got a little citrus note to it, a little sweetness to it. And yeah, you can kind of tell why that became our best-selling beer, and actually the best-selling farmhouse beer in Michigan.
I'm convinced. I mean, if this is an example of Belgian, this is my kind of Belgian.
So now we're going to go in a completely different direction. I've got our Belgian-inspired double IPA in front of you. It's called Tree Bucket. It is loaded with citra hops, and you're going to stick your nose in there and get just a ton of like tropical kind of pineapple notes to it. There's some sweetness from the yeast that we're using, and it's just a really smooth and well-balanced double IPA.
Well, like Lester, I really like a hoppy beer, and this totally delivers, but it's really clean and
That's part of the thing I didn't like about Belgians, the ones I've had, is that there was always seemed to be an aftertaste that bothered me, and I'm not picking that up in these beers. I really like this.
So I always really like sour things, and so I'm inclined to like sour beers, which is definitely a style we associate with Belgian beers. But I'm often surprised to me that they don't necessarily drink like beers, right? They feel like something else to me. And I really enjoy these because that little hint of maybe something sour going on, a little bit more complexity, but it still very much is beer.
I'm looking at your list here, and you've got an oat stout. I love oat stouts. I mean, these are not what I would consider Belgians.
Well, we're definitely taking some inspiration from the oldies but goodies in southern Belgium and kind of that northern France region, but we're definitely making it our own.
That's what I really love about craft brewing is how experimental you can be. Because craft brewers can work at really small batch sizes, you can just play around and test things and see if they work in a way that, you know, the big brewers can't do that sort of thing. So it's amazing the creativity that comes out of craft beer.
Now, don't get me wrong, sampling beer is a lot of fun, but I really wanted to go into the brew house and see how it's done. I just got a second to grab head brewer Jacob Durillo.
What do you think people would appreciate about Brewery Vivant?
I think the style of beers that we make, you know, we focus on the Belgian-French inspiration, and those are kind of our house strains, and, you know, we might dabble outside that box a little bit.
With the Michigan twist, I guess.
Yeah, everything's, we try to focus locally as much as we can, which is what our restaurant does, and yeah, it's kind of fun. Keep it local and keep it fun.
And then our beer abbess, Kate Avery, wanted us to try a sip of a couple more samples. I know, it's a tough job.
All right, Kate, so you just poured something for me, and I have to say this is one of the most interesting beers I've had. Definitely has what I think of as a Belgian character with some sour, but I want to say like pineapple and coconut. Really interesting.
So much is going on in that habanango.
Habanango, I knew there was something tropical going on there.
Habanango is a barrel-aged sour beer, again, pretty light in color, but then we age it, we finish it with some habanero peppers and some mango. So you're definitely getting on the nose that kind of fruit character, that tropicalness, and as you continue to take sips, a subtle little heat kind of builds from the habanero. It's not overpowering, it's fairly subtle. Also a great food pairing beer, but also one you could just enjoy a glass of, I think.
So this house sour, this reminds me a lot of a lambic.
It's a very light-colored golden beer, but it's soured up with kind of our own house culture at this point. And that's very typical, traditional Belgian. It's you're getting influence from your area, from your agriculture, and from the local microflora, microfauna. You talk about a lambic, it's got that nice tartness. And for us, we call it the house sour. It's just a light, easy drinking sour, a nice introduction to the world of complex sours. And thinking along the lines of like a house wine, here it is, you can come to Brewery Vivant and the house sour is always on.
So how do you encourage people who have been Bud Light drinkers or Coors Light drinkers all their lives that this is something that they will appreciate and it's not snooty?
Well, here's the thing. If you're interested in, you know, taking your taste buds on a little adventure, this is kind of the perfect time for you to be alive. And here in Michigan and here in Grand Rapids, you're definitely seeing just a rainbow of different beer flavors. And so it's not so much something that you have to replace your go-to drink with, but I think the more exploration, that attitude that you can have, the better shape you'll be in here in Grand Rapids and here in Beer City.
That's Kate Avery with Brewery Vivant. Tammy,
cheers.
Cheers.
On yesterday's show, we featured a conversation with the attorney and family of Raheel Siddiqui, the Marine recruit from Taylor, whose death at Parris Island in March of 2016 has sparked controversy and allegations of a cover-up. We talked with a United States Marine Corps spokesman in Virginia who said they would have an official response to our questions, as well as to the claims made in the interview, in time for today's show. We're still waiting for that statement. We'll make that available online as soon as we can. One correction for yesterday. We stated that the date for Gunnery Sergeant Joseph Felix General Court-Martial was next week on August 7th. According to Captain Joshua Penna, the date for the court-martial is between October 30th and November 10th at Marine Corps Base Camp Lejeune at North Carolina. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. There are concerns that this summer, Lake Erie will experience the same kind of toxic algal blooms that caused Toledo's water supply to be shut off 3 years ago. Researchers monitor Lake Erie to detect cyanobacteria blooms as early as possible, but it takes time to go out, gather the samples, bring them back to the lab for analysis. The researchers are getting some faster help this year. Tim Davis is a researcher with the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration's Great Lakes Environmental Research Laboratory. Before we talk about your new tool, remind us why we have this problem. What's causing these algal blooms?
Algal blooms are basically the visual symptom of an underlying problem, which is nutrient pollution. So both nitrogen and phosphorus entering our lakes at high concentrations and high loads are causing these events to take place. They've been happening for about 15 years, and if the status quo remains, they'll continue to happen and likely get worse as our climate changes.
Okay, so let's talk about that just a little bit, because Michigan Fertilizer Law of 1994 restricted the use of phosphorus fertilizers on residential and commercial lawns like your home or golf courses or athletic fields. Phosphorus and automatic dishwasher detergents became a thing of the past in Michigan in 2010. Where is all this phosphorus pollution coming from?
Most of it is coming from agriculture. We are very careful not to paint agriculture in an evil light, but in order to grow crops, farms need to fertilize, which means applying phosphorus and nitrogen to their fields. farmers have traditionally used excess phosphorus and nitrogen in order to make sure that they get the highest yield possible. And
right,
for very
called
good
insurance
reason.
Applications, because it's just a little bit of cost for making sure that you have enough fertilizer in case a rain comes and washes some of it off, right?
Absolutely. But that's exactly what we're concerned about, is the precipitation, rinsing some of those phosphorus and nutrient concentrations into the rivers, which eventually make it into Lake Erie. That's what's causing these issues. While point source pollution has largely been decreased due to the Great Lakes Water Quality Agreement.
Okay, explain what point source is.
So nutrients coming in from industry, like if there's a pipe that you can go to and it's a pipe that's coming from industry or a
sewer plant
or you know, water treatment plant or a septic tank, those are point sources. They're sources that we can go back to and say, this is the problem. Non-point source pollution, like agricultural runoff, CAFOs, concentrated animal farming, those are non-point source. So it's harder to deal with those, but those are creating a bulk of the nutrients that are coming into the Western Basin and other parts of the Great Lakes as well.
Okay, so we have these algal blooms. I mean, we've seen algae. It seems harmless. Why is it leading to these toxins?
The algae that are producing these blooms, that cause these blooms, are a natural part of the community. What happens is when we get these high concentrations of nitrogen and phosphorus, they grow very quickly and end up dominating. So while they produce these compounds naturally, they're not producing these compounds to harm us. They've been around for millions and millions of years, and they're producing these compounds for millions and millions of years. They don't really care too much about whether we're here or not. When they grow in high concentrations, that's when you get a buildup of these toxins, which can lead to human health, animal health, socioeconomic impacts.
So what kind of health problems are we talking about?
The main toxin in these blooms in the western basin of Lake Erie is microcystin. It's a hepatotoxin, which means it impacts the liver. So at what we consider to be acute toxicity, it can essentially cause liver failure and lead to death. But chronic or low-level exposure can lead to other symptoms like vomiting, diarrhea, other gastrointestinal issues. And if you get in contact with these blooms, if you swim in them or if they get on your skin, they can cause dermatological issues like rashes.
So the consequences are fairly serious. I mean, especially if it led to death. Why are there no regulations to require farmers to use less fertilizer? Everything we've got so far has been voluntary.
These are very political issues. What you're essentially doing is telling farmers how to run their operations. And as we all know, farmers are fiercely independent. Most of these have been generational after generation farmers. They have ways of doing things. And every time we ask them to change, it costs money. We tried no-till, and that was a good step, but it wasn't the ultimate solution that we thought it would be. So how do you create a law that's fair to all people involved, as well as positively impacting the environment? That's not an easy challenge, but it's one that needs to happen.
Let's get back to your tool. This year, you'll be able to get tests back on these algal blooms faster because of what you've described as a lab in a can. What is it?
What this instrument does is it takes a sample of water, it concentrates it, it extracts all the toxins out of the water, and then it analyzes and gives us a quantitative number for the amount of toxins in the water. It is a significant increase in our ability to have a near real-time toxin monitoring network in the lake, and it's the first one to ever be used in fresh water anywhere in the world.
Okay, how much time are you saving here?
For example, the ESP will be able to run through its entire process.
What's
and get
ESP stand for?
Environmental Sample Processor.
Okay.
This is our lab in a can. So our lab in a can will take in a sample of water, and it will run through its entire process in about 4 hours. For us to go out, collect a sample, drive back to the lab, filter, extract, analyze it, it can take anywhere from 24 hours to 48 hours. We are significantly increasing our turnaround time. And that's important because the more time we can give and the better quality data we can provide to water managers, whether they're water treatment plants or beach managers, that allows them to put safeguards in place.
So this lab in a can is actually sitting on the bottom of Lake Erie at some place. How does it get the test results to researchers?
ESP Niagara, which is our name for our lab in a can, is sitting at the bottom of Lake Erie, and it has a buoy that sits at the surface that has a modem. And what that does is it sends us back the data over a cellular network. So I'm sitting in my office, and as soon as Niagara is done sampling and running the analysis, I get an email where I can go in and check the image. We have some partners that do a little post-quality control on that image, and we can generate toxin concentration.
Now, as you mentioned, there's only one of these environmental sample processors in the Great Lakes region. Where did you place it to best monitor this problem?
Just off of Little Cedar Point, which is on the eastern side of Maumee Bay. And the reason why we put it there is because based on a study that just came out earlier this year, it was shown that the Toledo water crisis of 2014 was caused because Lake Erie's circulation, the water circulation pattern that set up in Lake Erie due to a north wind, flushed Maumee Bay and pushed it east along the Ohio coastline, and the north winds kept it concentrated on that south shore and pushed it right in front of the Toledo water intake. So we placed ESP Niagara off of the eastern point of Maumee Bay so that would intercept that water before it reached the intake so that we could generate data and get it to water managers before the bloom ever got to the intake.
So it's right in the path of the past problem. Is that single testing site enough, or are researchers still gathering samples in other places?
One sampling site is never enough. There are multiple teams, both federal from USGS as well as NOAA, academic institutions such as Bowling Green State University and University of Toledo, Ohio State University. We all have monitoring programs that are going out either on a weekly or biweekly basis to keep tabs on the bloom and the toxicity. So the ESP is a fantastic tool. It's a significant increase in our ability to monitor, but it's not the only piece of equipment we need.
How bad are the algal blooms this year?
This year, the bloom is still setting up. It's still developing right now. We haven't seen peak bloom, but it's projected to be a fairly significant bloom. We project the size of the bloom based on the amount of phosphorus runoff coming in from the western basin of Lake Erie watershed. And this year, it's projected to be on a scale of 1 to 10, anywhere between a 7 and a 9.
So is this going to threaten Toledo's water source? I mean, are we going to have the same kind of rumble we did 3 years ago?
Hopefully not. No one can predict the future. But anytime there's a bloom, there is a risk of human health impacts, whether it's from drinking water or recreation. There's always a risk. But while 2014 Toledo event was serious, and we hope will never happen again, we have to remember that over the past 15 plus years that these blooms have been occurring, there have only been a handful of events where drinking water has been impacted. So for the most part, drinking water plants have the ability to deal with the cells and the toxin before it reaches the public's tap.
So this has only been happening the last 15 years. What does this toxic algal bloom say about the overall health of Lake Erie? Why is this happening? You know, Lake Erie was declared dead in the 1960s, and everybody's been thrilled about how well it's been doing. And now you say in the last 15 years it's gotten worse?
That's right. It's what we call the re-eutrophication of Lake Erie. And that's just a fancy word for saying that Lake Erie is becoming polluted with nutrients, very much like it was back in the 70s before the Clean Water Act and the Great Lakes Water Quality Agreement. So back in the 60s and 70s, as you mentioned, we saw low oxygen events. We saw harmful algal blooms, similar as we do today. So Lake Erie is an example of how laws and binational partnerships can improve the health of the system. Because like you said, Lake Erie was considered dead. And by reducing point source phosphorus pollution into Lake Erie, we were able to restore the health of Lake Erie into the 1980s. But what the issue is that we declared Lake Erie clean and a lot of the monitoring programs subsided. And we took our finger off the ball. Unfortunately, these non-point source pollution started to ramp up, started to increase, and then these problems kind of snuck back up on us in the mid-90s. Now we're back in the same position we were in the 70s trying to control them.
That's Tim Davis. He's with NOAA's Great Lakes Environmental Research Laboratory. Thanks very much for talking with us about this.
Thank you, Lester. It's great to be on.
We decided to see whether farmers were doing anything about reducing fertilizer contamination. We went to the Isley Farm, which lies within the River Raisin watershed. The raisin feeds into Lake Erie. Laurie Isley is the president of the Lenawee County Farm Bureau. Her husband, Jim Isley, was an early adopter of the Michigan Agricultural Environmental Assurance Program, or MEEP. Their farm is certified and among a small percentage of farms using strip tilling, a proven way to reduce fertilizer runoff and reduce soil erosion. We asked them what's involved in MEEP.
The MEEP is a program designed to give a set of guidelines for farmers to follow And by doing that, they can implement practices that are friendlier for the environment and promote sustainability.
Why do you think that's important? Why did you get involved in this and get certified? Because it took a little doing to get there.
Oh, we were verified in the meat program, I believe, in the spring of 2013. Why we wanted to be meat verified was to show our friends and show our neighbors that we are conscious of the environment and that we're doing what we can to farm sustainably, not only for the environment, but also financially.
Now, your farm sits within the River Raisin watershed, which eventually enters Lake Erie, which we've all been hearing about Lake Erie's problems with this algal blooms, and that's being blamed in part on agriculture. If we know about this problem in Toledo, and we know that agriculture might have some role to play in it, why do you think farmers have been resistant rather than saying, hey, we better get on top of this before somebody comes in and says, you've got to do this?
Sometimes I believe that it's natural for a farmer to think that if it's environmentally friendly, that it may not be good for the bottom line. And it's our goal on this farm to show that, yes, it can be both. I think that's part of the reason, or one of the reasons, is that there's a lot of programs out there that encourage producers to be environmentally active and offer some incentives to start different programs. In this community, there are a number of individuals. We mentioned strip till. A couple of good friends of mine were some of the first individuals in this area to start strip tillage.
One of the things that's been around for a long, long time are buffer strips. That is a grassy strip before in front of a waterway to kind of protect that runoff, at least to get a little filter before. And yet when I drive around and I look at farm fields, there are a lot of cases where it's not buffered, and there's almost gullies washing through fields, and there are, well, I'll just say, some bad actors out there. They're not doing what you guys are doing. So is there peer pressure when it comes to something like that?
There's some peer pressure, but a lot of farmers have been doing things a certain way for a really long period of time, and it's difficult sometimes to convince them to change. There are programs, government programs, that will do filter strips where there is some money available, and that often is a pretty good incentive to get them to try something new and hopefully then be able to see how that works. We have had some pretty strong success in the River Raisin watershed. There have been some tests run on the river that have shown a 40% reduction in the phosphorus, and that seems to be what they're most concerned with as far as the algal bloom is being considered, that it's the phosphorus that seems to have the most impact on that, although the nitrogen plays a role as well. But we're just hoping that we can continue to do this voluntarily, because of course it has been declared as an impaired watershed by the state of Michigan, and we want to make sure that we can take steps to make those improvements before those are mandated for us.
I think that might be the key on this whole thing, though, because people who have lawns or athletic fields or golf courses, they're voluntarily reducing their nitrogen and phosphorus applications. Farmers are being asked to voluntarily do it. Yet we saw a city lose its water supply for a while and is at risk of doing it again. That seems like it'll take more than a voluntary effort.
Well, perhaps, but I don't think all the results from a voluntary action are really in yet. I'd be curious to wait and have this conversation perhaps in September of this year, after the algal bloom season has passed, if it has passed by then, and see what the reduction has really been. There's been a lot of effort on producers, some of the producers that I know, to reduce fertilizer applications to only what the crop needs.
So this program that Michigan has put together, this MEAP program, stands for Michigan Agriculture Environmental Assurance Program. This is not just another government program. This is fairly unique, fairly early, and other states are starting to copy that. So what makes this so special?
We think it's special because it was put together by farmers, had input into it. It's science-based rather than just whatever the thought of the moment is, which we see a lot of with the Lake Erie issue. And it has a sustainability component to it. You don't just do it once and then you have it forever. It has to be reapplied for periodically. And if there are issues, then you can lose that verification. So there's also something that you're encouraged to maintain the levels of which you've that you've signed up for. And there's an outside individual that comes to do it, so that actually takes you through that. So there's also that objectivity piece to it. So we think that those are some of the things that make it especially beneficial.
So how's it working for you? Seriously, is it caused any problems with production output or anything like that?
No. We've seen a great reduction in wind erosion, and I think we've seen a substantial increase in moisture retention since we're not tilling the soil. If you take a look at our ground where we planted corn, you see a lot of corn stubble from 2 years ago, plus bean stubble from the last year, protecting the soil. And that's a great thing, especially in times like, you know, here we are in the 1st of August and really could use a rain. The variable rate fertilizer application has been outstanding, because I can show you fields that have had the same fertilizer input for the last 40 years, and there are some spots that just don't produce. It's the type of soil. And so there's really no reason to apply fertilizer where it's not used, and so we've been able to cut back that way. On the flip side of that coin, we see soils or different areas of our fields that produce very, very well, and perhaps maybe we haven't reached the maximum yield on those areas. So I'm very, very encouraged with the strip tillage, with the variable rate seeding. So far, it's been very, very positive. There are some issues, though. There have been issues of finding qualified operators for the equipment, because it is more technical today than what it used to be. But we're overcoming that. I'm learning.
It's you. It's not your son. That is Jim Isley along with Laurie Isley. They operate a Michigan Agriculture Environmental Assurance Program certified farm in Lenawee County. Thanks very much.
Thank you
so much.
Today's Stateside was directed by Mike Blank and engineered by Peg Watson. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Mercedes Mejia, Allie Billings, Lindsay Scullin, and Tyler Scott. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Lester Graham.